after that intimidating introduction. It's a pleasure to be back, and I actually see that pretty much as promised. I was going to apologize in advance if you were at the conference about 6 weeks ago for hearing an essentially identical talk, but I see a bunch of new faces, and I encourage people to stop me as we go along. If we're running over time, I can make adjustments and leave out certain sections, so please do ask questions. So I'll be talking about work that's being done as part of essentially a three-point collaboration, but starting with a very long-standing one between Chris Palmstrom and myself, and the imaging experiments that I'll be talking about in the first part of the talk were done in collaboration with Scott Kirker at the Los Alamos National Lab. It's really the people on the left here who have done the work. I'll particularly cite Jawa, who's in addition to fabricating all the devices you'll see where the material was grown by Christoph Edelman, Jawa's been doing the transport experiments that I'll talk about at the end of the talk. Right, so I'll start out with a bit of an overview, sort of technical or technological in focus about sort of where the fundamental problems that we're trying to solve are. These will break down to those of spin injection, spin transport, and detection. We would like to do all of these in one single device, and this is what I'll be talking about today, with the caveat that they won't all be will not all be studied in a single measurement, although that is the goal of this work. David alluded to, there's been some very nice imaging experiments that we've done that's associated with this stage of the work, but this is moving towards an entirely electrical scheme for spin injection and detection. And in the last third of the talk, I'll be talking about this progress in electrical detection of spin accumulation. Okay, so here is a sort of a cartoon, a schematic, what I sometimes call the ritually obligatory SpinFET cartoon that has not yet been constructed. But if we imagine sort of the simplest functional device that an engineer might want to make out of some ferromagnet semiconductor hybrid, would involve two ferromagnetic electrodes sitting at the opposite ends of some channel. And the question is, how would the transimpedance of this device depend on the magnetization state of these two ferromagnetic electrodes? So if you want to see this thing working, you can get up and leave now, because at the end of the talk we'll not quite be there, although we'll be pretty bloody close. But there are a bunch of reasons why such an object might be difficult to construct, and this is how I'm going to sort of break up the talk. The first thing that we need to do is to get spins out of the ferromagnetic source contact and into the drain. This place is just large enough that the mechanical pointer is... Is it better if I'm not actually reaching in front? The first problem is to get spins out of this ferromagnetic source contact into the semiconductor. We would like to do this achieving some sort of polarization here that's comparable to the spin polarization in iron. The next step would be to move the spins down this channel over dimensions that might be of order several microns. And then finally, one wants to extract the spins at the tail end of this structure, basically measuring their state with the second contact. So one would be in a situation where this device might have a different resistance depending on what we do with the magnetization state of the second electrode. Okay, so that's the, so those are the three things we need to do: injection, transport, and detection. In between, we would like to be able to manipulate the electron spin. Perhaps the simplest way that this can be done is to apply a transverse magnetic field. And in the geometry I show here, this field is not doing anything to the magnetizations of the contacts themselves. They will be fixed. And the idea now is that between these two points, the electron can process about this applied magnetic field. And in many of the proposals, particularly the theorists in the audience you're familiar with, this real magnetic field can be replaced by a factitious spin orbit field. And in fact, that was really the point of the original Dada-Das proposal. Right, so now With the aid of one of those two elements, you know, we can actually rotate the spins through some angle between source and drain. So now they're arriving at the second electrode with the state that's not determined entirely by that of the first electrode. Okay, so the intransimpedance should depend on the precession angle. Right. This step that really has never been unambiguously demonstrated in any semiconductor spin transport device, in the sense that it doesn't show a Hanley effect. And I just want to make quite precise what this is, because there are two elements to the Hanley effect. The first, which we're all aware of, is that if you stick a spin in a transverse magnetic field, it will precess. Right? However, there's both spin relaxation and also real diffusion that occurs in one of these structures, and this has a second consequence as well. So imagine this cartoon where we have our first contact here, our second contact here, and we inject electrons with some spin that I show by the red arrows. And in this case here, there's no spin relaxation at all. This is also essentially a completely ballistic picture, so these electrons just travel, all taking the same amount of time to get from this electrode to this electrode. Right. Now, in practice, this is not what actually happens. I turn on our magnetic field, indeed, the spins start to precess, but at a given point in the structure, due to diffusion, the spins have arrived with some sort of distribution of times, so some of them getting there a little bit sooner than others, so therefore there will be a distribution of precessional phases, and as the magnetic field is increased further, and you go far enough downstream, in fact, this distribution of phase angles is essentially 2 pi or greater, and the spins are distributed uniformly over this azimuth perpendicular to the field direction. Right. So the effect of the transverse field here is to cause this eventual complete dephasing of the spins, and this has for the sort of on the scale of judging whether you have a real spin transport effect in a device of this nature is the real acid test. If the effect is real, applying a small transverse field should A, induce these precessional effects, but for a sufficiently large field, which actually in the case of the semiconductors in the doping range I'll talk about today is on the order of 100 oersted, it should be sufficient to destroy the effect. Okay, and once again, this is done in the case where the magnetic field does not actually influence the magnetizations of the contacts. Okay, so there are a bunch of things here that work, and I'll blow through these quite quickly. The first is, and this is like bringing coals to Newcastle, the first is the spin transport in the gallium arsenide itself. For any length scale that poses difficulties for us, this is simply not a factor, right? And the doping ranges that I'll be talking about today, the diffusion lengths can be tens of microns, and spin lifetimes actually up to and above 100 nanoseconds. So really in that cartoon picture I've been showing, there'll be no problem in physically moving spins from one side of the device to another before they relax completely. Right. The second thing which I'll just knock off as solved, although this has taken a lot of work over the last several years, is that of injection from the ferromagnetic metal. Right. So it is now possible in a variety of systems to maintain steady state spin polarizations in the semiconductor, and that most of this work has been done in the so-called spin light emitting diodes. But it is possible to maintain steady state spin polarizations in the semiconductor that are actually comparable to the spin polarization of iron. So here's some of our data showing for a quantum well spin detector basically a steady state polarization of about 30%. 3/4 of the polarization of iron. All right. So those are two aspects of this problem that appear to be resolved reasonably well. I'll make one point about the spin injection, is that virtually all of this work has been on these spin light emitting diodes, and we really haven't done much physics with these systems yet. In other words, we inject the spin into some sort of quantum well, as many of you are familiar with. the state of the spin can be read out with circularly polarized light that's done necessarily right at the source. Yes? Yes, so here actually this guy is already under bias, in this case about 2 volts, right? And that's actually this is some Poisson Schrodinger simulation, but that's actually very close to the typical threshold voltages for these metal. So this is basically a Schottky and a PIN diode in series. Essentially this sort of being slave to the spin LED has limited us somewhat in the amount of physics we can do. Okay. All right, so the question is then, and I'm not sort of reviewing the entire history of this field, but there have been a lot of measurements of one type or another on metal, on iron, semiconductor iron, and everything has been sort of ambiguous. And is it possible to actually do some sort of definitive characterization? And that's really how this program of measurements started out. In other words, well, if we know that a couple things work, but the whole device doesn't work, let's go in and look at it stage by stage. And this is where our collaboration with Scott Crooker came in. And the idea is to send the patient in for a scan. In this case, the scan will be magneto-optical Kerr imaging. And the patient, at least at the beginning, I guess in this business we do have the luxury of being able to choose our patients, unlike real doctors. The patient is by design a very simple device, right? A long channel of N-type gallium arsenide doped a few times 10 to the 16th with two of these tunnel Schottkys. These are the same design that we've developed for our work on the spin light emitting diodes, but now without any of this diode structure on the back, so just a tunnel barrier, which are at each end of the channel. The spatial separation is enormous. After actually first starting with separations much smaller, we realized that in order to figure out everything going on, we should separate the source, which when I say that, will mean source of electrons, from the drain at the other end of the structure. Okay. The measurement is quite simple in concept. The idea is we can, as many of you are familiar with magneto-optical techniques, you are sensitive to the Z component of the spin in a simple polar measurement like this. So if we are collecting light out with a microscope objective at one point in the device, we inject electrons with their spins in the plane. This is the case for just the thin film shape anisotropy. These spins move downstream under bias. They also diffuse. And we have a small magnetic field. And in the measurements I'll be describing in the first part of the talk, this magnetic field is applied in the plane and perpendicular to the magnetization of the contacts. The spins precess in that magnetic field, and we will be looking at the Z component of the spin. Right, so the idea is if we're looking near the source, so this is sort of this cartoon here reflects what we originally thought we would see. We might see this cloud of spin polarization that's emitted from the source precessing in this small transverse magnetic field. Right, so for the purposes of discussion here, without discussing any experimental details, I will be showing you now data where the signal is always proportional to the Z component of the electron spin.
How high is that
pillar? Some tens of nanometers. This was done, basically this extra etch, to put it high up on a mesa, was done because of original concerns about fringe fields. Right? Because those will extend over a length that's comparable to the thickness of your ferromagnetic film. And that's only 50 angstroms in these devices. So the whole idea here was just to put it up, or etch this down, rather, so that that was out of the picture. It's also true that we want to remove this heavily doped layer that's right behind the interface over the body of the structure. However, that would only require like a 15 nanometer etch, and this was actually made significantly deeper. Right, so why do we need it? Because it's just simplest to image Z component of the spin. Right, so we want to process. Right. Yeah, and it turns out that this is a very convenient way to do things, because in addition to that being easy, it's easy to measure the Z component of the spin. In principle, you could measure one of the other Kerr effects and measure the in-plane components of the spin, right? But this will also allow us to sort of do this dephasing type measurement reasonably easily. Okay, so that being said, that all we're going to be looking at is z component of spin. Here is what is seen, right? So in fact, pretty much as I advertised, this is for a magnetic field here of about 4 Gauss that's applied in the plane. So this is in the plane, but it's not, once again, not doing anything to the magnetization of the electrode, which actually is a very large magnetocrystalline anisotropy in addition to the in-plane shape anisotropy. We see this cloud building up as they move out from underneath the source, and then this decays away due to diffusion. Right? This stripe here, I'm extremely reluctant to tell you to focus on that for two reasons. The first is that there is magneto-optical signal coming from the iron and underneath the iron. Right? I would like to go back and now do these measurements with thicker electrodes. The reason to do them with nice thin iron is we have this huge surface-induced anisotropy that we exploit. Right. Yeah, pardon?
What are the colors?
Okay, so maximum spin here is white. All right, so the color scale, oh, which I knocked off here, I'm sorry. The color scale goes from white and blue is zero.
Incomplete.
Yeah, and this is all out of plane spin. Yeah. Because this technique images z component of the spin.
So the fast part of plane is near the jump?
Right. Yes. The you would expect it to actually take some time. And you can see this by doing the types of simulations we were talking about this morning, right? But I don't want to send people home to build some model that explains the details of this image near the contact because of various experimental effects that I would prefer not to sort of get into in great detail, right? I'll talk about field dependence in a moment. All right. So the point of this view graph is this is spin polarization, this contrast. It's observed as expected, coming out from the source over a length scale that was pretty much expected, given what we know about this material. I'll get back to that in a moment. I will note at this stage that the one surprise, at least us at this first stage, was the observation of this small. Much smaller but still noticeably non-zero signal that came near the drain. In other words, this is where electrons, unpolarized electrons, because this device is so long, is incident on the drain contact. And this is reminiscent of, in fact, will be what has been called ferromagnetic imprinting by the CUCSB group.
Do you see some magnetoresistance in this system?
Okay, I will talk about transport at the end. I will say yes. If you just put two wires down, right? Actually, unfortunately, you can see it even if they're far apart. You will measure a magnetoresistance, right? And it's because the interpretation of those measurements has been so difficult that we're doing this.
So there is some anisotropy or magnetoresistance?
Yeah. First of all, you have it in the contacts themselves. We got rid of that reasonably easily. But then there are several classes of effects that aren't simply what I was alluding to on my opening cartoon, okay. Right? But yeah, you can put wires down. You'll see sort of double-step switching, which has, unfortunately, at the first stage, nothing to do with real transport from source to drain. Yeah, I'll come back to that at the end. Right. So indeed, if the current is reversed, as you would expect, it's very difficult to make the contacts exactly symmetric, but the contrast in the image is inverted, so now electrons are flowing from right to left, and this large cloud is observed at the source. Okay, so now the field, field dependence, right? And I'm going to do this here because for the rest of the talk, I'm really just going to be talking about these curves, which can be inferred from the images, which are of course the real original data. And if you imagine starting, so this is actually what is measured. If I sit at a particular point, and for each applied magnetic field, we can obtain an image like I just showed you. Just showed you from one, this is actually a different set of measurements, but one that was probably about this field, yeah, a few Gauss. If we sit at a fixed point and measure the z component of the spin as a function of field, right, we can trace out this curve. Right? So that's basically sitting at this point and accumulating data, a whole bunch of fields, and composing this curve as a function of field. And it has three important features. The first is that at zero magnetic field, there is no contrast. That does not mean there's no contrast in the spatial image. This is actually equal to a background that is inferred separately. Then at some small magnetic field, the signal goes through a peak. This is, roughly speaking, where you've accumulated a significant component of the precessed spin out of plane. Then at sufficiently high magnetic field, the signal dies off to zero. Right? So this is characteristic of what is measured near the source in any of these experiments. Right? And I'll be proceeding henceforth on the assumption that these curves pretty much contain all the essential physics. So I'll tell you whether we're near the source or near the drain, but a full two-dimensional image is not really necessary to get at what we want to extract from these systems. Okay. Then the final thing we can do is flip the magnetization. Right? We can do this by basically applying a very large field along the contact direction to flip it. Right? So this is basically a field in the x direction. And as you would expect if this signal is real, this curve, which I just showed you, flips when the magnetization flips. Right? So we can flip M or we can flip B. And in both cases, we change the z component of the spin as would be expected. Right? If you were skeptical about my original claim that this little stripe that appears near the drain is real, it has A, the Hanley type signature that we expect, and B, it also flips when the magnetization is flipped. Okay, so here is a summary of our principal observations. All right, we have this cloud of spins that is emitted from the source with a characteristic diffusion length of about 30 microns. The polarization, this is difficult to calibrate. It's another number which I wouldn't want someone to spend lots of time trying to calculate to multiple significant digits. Within a factor of two or so, it's about 5%. The white in this image corresponds to a spin polarization of about 5%. So somewhat smaller than we measure in spin LEDs, although we're not doing this right underneath the contact anymore. The sign corresponds to injection of majority spins, right, the higher polarization of the Fermi level. It reverses when the magnetization is reversed. I would say these first four items here, we went into this essentially expecting to see if things worked as we thought they should. The spin accumulation at the drain, this is observed under with the contact under forward bias, so where electrons are incident on the Schottky barrier from the semiconductor side. I won't be going into great detail here, but we believe the mechanism is essentially the same as observed in Jason Stevens's work here. And in this case, the sign of the polarization is the same as the injected polarization, in other words, also majority spin. And that is something that, to this date, I don't have a really solid understanding of why. So I'll go briefly here through some modeling of these data. I'm not going to spend a tremendous amount of time on this, but it's useful in interpreting the transport measurements at the end of the talk. So the question is, can we now take those Hanley curves that I've shown you and interpret what we see as a function of position inside the system? At both source and drain. So this cartoon here shows qualitatively what I've shown you so far. So spins are indeed injected from this contact. They relax as they move out into the channel. They precess in the magnetic field. So I've tried to show that by the direction of the arrows. I have not shown the dephasing. There's also this effect due to the spin accumulation at the drain contact, which is somewhat less efficient, right? Once those mechanisms are accepted, in other words, we get this spin polarization somehow, how it evolves with magnetic field, position, and time will just be given by this modified drift diffusion equation. So this is the ordinary drift diffusion equation for the charge carriers, and this is just sort of single particle physics. We attach the spins to the charge. There's a relaxation term, and then finally there's precession of the spin in the field. And you know, you can hand this to a graduate student and ask them to solve it. I will say, remind you that this is a steady state experiment. We're doing this under DC bias. So we solve this thing and set the SDT equal to zero. Okay. Many of the parameters that appear here, the diffusion constant, drift velocity, spin lifetime, can be measured by other techniques. So we know in the latter part, I won't distinguish here between the cases where we have absolutely measured all these independently and those where we've made them parameters. In the latter part of the talk, we've measured basically everything on the left here, plus we set the G factor to the literature value for gallium arsenide. Okay. So based on this, we can say, okay, we have a certain detection spot that's in our channel. We can solve that drift diffusion equation for what we expect at this position. Right? This is the answer, so it basically involves an integral over all times because this is steady state, and also an integral over the contact because it's an extended source. Right? In the first part here, we'd assume we have some detection spot, and we can do that as a function of position moving out from the contact. So on the right here, these are the parameters used, right, which are all very essentially what are expected from transport or other measurements. And as we move out from the contact, we see this behavior in the model. So close to the contact is exactly as my qualitative description before was, this sort of S-shaped curve, the signal dying out here due to dephasing. And on the left side here, again, starting 8 microns from the contact and moving out to 120 is the experimental data. Right? The good news, first off, is that near the contact, things agree with the story that I've told you so far. There appears to be one extra element as we go away from the contact, in other words, move far downstream, so these extra oscillations. But that's really not difficult to explain, the same phenomenon. Yes?
If you moved all the way to the drain, would you see the increase of the extra spin accumulated?
Yeah, I'll get to that. However, in between, it definitely goes to zero. So I'm showing here the first 120 microns, and I will later show you like 20 microns near the drain, and in between, there's nothing. All right. Okay. So this first part here, where we observe this behavior, is where we're within a diffusion length of the source. When you're further downstream, you can actually see that this kernel here becomes peaked, and it's basically just set by the time that it takes the electrons to drift in the electric field. So if we're far downstream, further than a diffusion length from the source, basically things are dominated by the drift, not diffusion, and then there really is a characteristic time for electrons to arrive at a certain position. Right? And so this basically allows you to measure the G factor of the electrons just by their time of, it's essentially a time of flight measurement. We do it as a function of magnetic field. So the peak of this oscillation here does correspond to spins that have processed through 2 pi in getting to the detection point. Right? So here's data for 2 states of the contact. Here's the model. And you can even just slice off, you know, this here's pi over 2 here, a quarter cycle here, and compare that with exactly what you'd expect for the G factor of gallium arsenide, and it works. Okay. So that stuff is reasonably straightforward. In other words, if you believe the drift diffusion equation and spin precession, you'd pretty much get what we see. Okay. So the question was asked, well, what about the drain? And as far as the spatial dependence, in other words, what we see in the channel of the device, things also work reasonably well. So on the left here is the model. The parameters here are exactly the same as before, except for one prefactor, because we'll assume some different spin generation mechanism. Here's the model curves. We'll see here that things decay much more quickly. So 300 microns is the location of the drain. This is 298, so this is 2 microns off. This is 12 microns off, so this thing decays very rapidly. In this case, diffusion is fighting drift, so electrons are diffusing out from the contact, and they're being pushed in, by the electric field, and that's basically the reason for the rapid attenuation. The fact that this can be seen at all in the channel region of the device, so the one thing that is different in Jason's experiment is there, they were looking immediately underneath the contact. We have, by design, because they emerge from our spin LEDs, much more transmissive barriers. So essentially, there's a much smaller electric field in the problem, and this is what allows this effect to be seen even out underneath, from underneath the contacts. Okay. I'm going to skip this next section of the talk, but it was a very nice idea, emanating originally from Yui Kato's work here, which Scott had to check basically that the statement I made was just true, that in fact spins at the drain were diffusing out into the channel against the drift velocity. And I'll just put up the result here. These are again these Hanley curves measured, but now with strain applied to the sample, right? And the interesting thing in this case, and the principle is simple, there's essentially a superposition of this spin orbit field. This always happens when you try and cut something out of a talk, right? Right. A superposition of this spin orbit field and the real field. And the idea was basically that these two superpositions, the two terms, could be identified, the spin orbit field basically from where the Hanley curves crossed zero, right? And the important observation that was made is that at opposite ends of this structure, the spin orbit contribution is of opposite sign. In other words, Hanley curves shift left at one end of the sample and right at the other end of the sample. And this is due to the fact that the spin orbit field depends on momentum, right? There's also this very strange shape of these curves can be modeled quite precisely, and I'll point you to this PRB if you're interested in that type of work. Okay, so a brief statement here about the drain, because in fact it's going to play a role in the next section of the talk, right? The spin accumulation we believe is due to some sort of reflection mechanism. So Lou and his co-workers have been working on this for a while. I hope that it's possible to extract some quantitative insight from what we've done. Fundamentally, I believe the mechanism is essentially the ferromagnetic imprinting. It's a different barrier design than in the UCSB samples. It's more transparent. The sign of the effect I still view as anomalous, although not impossible. So I'll point out that we're observing a majority spin polarization both at the source and the drain in our structures. My experimentalist instincts said, well, if we see majority at the source, meaning majority spins travel more easily through the barrier, then we should see an accumulation of minority spins at the drain. There are various reasons why that might not be the case, particularly if there's some sort of energy selective or case selective spin filtering going on, right?
The difference between the accumulation due to reflection and filtering.
Well, okay, I agree with the statement. If you mean, I'm sorry. Okay. Oh, what is the difference? Okay, so I would so simple spin filtering I view just averaging over the entire density of state. So if I have a tunnel barrier, right, I will, for example, magnetic tunnel junction, right, I can determine the sign just by the densities of states on the two sides of the barrier, right. So for average density of states, you would predict majority for injection, which we see, right, and minority for extraction, which we don't see. Right? Now, once you allow for the fact that these are crystalline systems, right, and that you should take the appropriate average over momenta, I haven't thought about this at all as far as how to implement it. But then, you can look at the density of states for iron and different points in K space that has different signs. Right? So I'm just making the statement that it's not forbidden what we see by the filtering argument, but you'd have to include the momentum space dependence.
So the reflection is different from filtering.
Okay. They're not. All right. Okay.
Well, I
mean,
Stephen's experiment, when we have a full forward direction, and then a two-thirty isn't going to work. Right? The classical argument, if you go down the stack, the charge is going to go through. Nothing goes back. Of course, you still have to extend the accumulation.
Yeah. Right. Oh, okay. So the I mean, I may be convolving things in my head, but I'm assuming that all these arguments involve calculating transmission and reflection coefficients to some degree, and that if you asked me as an oral exam question how to do it, I would write down some Joulier-type formula, just with densities of states on the two sides of the structure, and that argument would give the wrong sign.
Well, transmission is also...
Yeah, pardon? Yes, so the transmission coefficient is where the kth dependence would come in. But we have not looked at this seriously, and the effect is relatively ubiquitous, so it's probably worth looking at. We should also note that the mechanism is relatively efficient. It certainly looks small in my images, but it is the same order of magnitude as the injection at the source, and this is going to play a role in the interpretation of transport experiments. Okay. So I will now shift gears to electrical spin detection. So this is really the last stage, what I identified as at the beginning as the most problematic aspect of these types of structures. Right? And the first experiment here is actually a return to an idea that we were doing several years ago, but we're getting sort of ambiguous results, and I resolved to stop it for a while. And that is, okay, the measurements I've just done imply that there's some difference in transmission of minority and majority spins at the drain. And you know, is there a way to verify this explicitly? In particular, does one channel have a higher conductance than the others? Right. And the way we did this was to take this type of structure that I've been showing you, and essentially to invert our measurement. So up to now, we've been applying some bias current and measuring spin polarization using a microscope objective. It's possible to turn this around and to use optical pumping to inject a spin of a known sign. Right? Once again, we'll have our transverse field. The spins will process in that field, and we can measure the conductance of the device. And the idea here was to look for a difference depending on whether the spins arrived at the drain electrode either parallel or anti-parallel. Right? And of course, we knew, based on all the modeling that I've talked about, exactly what these spins should be doing once they're injected into the system optically. Right?
Well, is there a subliminal message that, your wire is on top on the... No,
that's just my lousy PowerPoint technique. All right. In fact, there are gold electrodes on these structures that I haven't shown you, right? And they're always on top, right? So here, in fact, is an optical image of what's going on. In practice, actually, we use a second objective to do this experiment. So we don't literally turn the experiment around. We just come in with another beam. The spot is this little red dot. So that's where the spins are being injected. This cloud you see emanating out is a combination of drift and diffusion. Here is the contact, and now we can measure the conductance. And we see curves that look qualitatively exactly what I've been showing you up to now. All right, so now this is actually the change in conductance of the channel as a function of the field, which for one sign processes the spin in a direction where they are parallel to the spins in the electrode, and the other sign anti-parallel, right? And once again, we can flip the contrast just by inverting the magnetization. Right? So except for the fact that we're now injecting spin and measuring conductance as opposed to the other way around, these curves are very similar to what I showed you before. And in fact, this is the progression that you see as you move the injection spot further and further away from one end. And then if we invert the bias, here is it as we approach the other end. So everything I showed before, including these oscillations that are due to the time of flight, precession of the spin is observed. Right? And finally, I will say that you can actually determine in which state the conductance is higher, and it is higher in the minority channel. So that's consistent, at least, with the optical observation. Okay, so here we stand. I've shown you that it is possible to look at each element of this device separately. Actually, in a sense, a lot of things work. We can see the injection and transport, of course. We can even do electrical spin detection. The virtue of this is it now gives us an idea of what to look at when we're doing the sort of real experiment. And I will now move on to discussing that. The real experiment meaning to throw away our optics and just, I shouldn't use the word real, but the goal is to do a complete transport experiment. Okay. So Zhao set out to do this, and after several iterations, this is what we arrived at. The idea here was rather, we knew immediately, and I'm not even going to show you the data, that just hooking up two wires and measuring source to drain is pointless. Right. So what we decided to do was to have two source and drain contacts on a structure, and actually to put on some side contacts, both to do things like measure density for characterization, but also this would allow us to measure voltage drops at the source and drain independently. So if we're passing electrons now from one tunnel barrier through the device to the other barrier, we can measure the voltage drop at the source, the voltage drop at the drain, the voltage drop in the channel. Of course, we can also measure the voltage drop across the whole thing, if we wish, right? Similar progression occurred. We tried small separations, saw all sorts of stuff. We are going to start here showing you what the case is, a relatively large separation between the two ends, so there's going to be no actual transport from source to drain. The principle of the experiment was similar. To actually look for something in a perpendicular field. In this case, we're actually going to put it perpendicular to the substrate. This, again, with very small fields, will not be doing anything to the magnetizations. Right? So the barriers are identical in design to what we're using for the imaging experiments, but we have these additional contacts, and we can actually measure voltages, et cetera. And this is the ubiquitous feature of these structures. So the field is perpendicular, and we can measure under a bias which corresponds to about half a volt. They're actually current biased. In detail, what is measured, in this case, this is the voltage measured at the drain. So this would be, in this geometry, VEB, as a function of this perpendicular magnetic field. Right? What's observed is that high field, it actually follows this parabolic magnetoresistance that's also measured for the voltage drop across the channel. At low field, we observe this peak with a width of some tens of oersted or so.
Sorry, what is the distance from A to B compared to the...
So A to B?
Spin length.
Okay, so this is 150 microns. Uh-huh. And the spin length in these systems is actually a little bit shorter than in the... imaging data that I've shown you, it's about 10 microns. All right, so still much longer than that. All right. Okay, so one can measure, in this case, measuring the voltage just at the drain. Actually, I'm sorry, this measurement here is the voltage across the entire structure, was first observed this peak. Okay, and then skipping ahead. All right, so this is electrons flowing this way, so current is flowing this way. Now we're measuring just the drain, and that's the red data here. So you'll notice the exact same field dependence at the source. So this entire peak would appear to be due to something going on at the drain. So then you can go and measure the source and see nothing almost. So this is the voltage drop here, right? And then finally in the channel you see nothing at all except for a very broad background. If the current is inverted, okay, so here we have the zero field peak at the drain and nothing much going on in the source and channel, we can invert the current just to make sure there's nothing special about the particular electrode that's being used. And now, except for the fact that the electrode that used to be the drain is now the source and vice versa, we see the exact same thing. Right? So this is a property of the drain contact in these systems. For barriers of the transmissivity that I've been showing you, this is pretty much a universal effect. So here's another system. This actually is the doping, the same doping as in the imaging data. The same asymmetry is observed between source and drain. Right? You'll notice here the curves are somewhat narrower. Okay? We can do a bunch of other things, like look with aluminum samples. You don't see this. We've also done experiments in tilted fields, which verify that this really is magnetic. This here is what I will focus on now for an explanation. The first, you guys will probably have a lot of objections to, and that's as my explanation of why we don't see anything at the source. All right. So my understanding of this is that if you were to ask me to calculate a current, right, and we're tunneling into gallium arsenide, and we certainly know that there's a spin polarization here. We know it from the imaging experiments. We know it from the spin LED experiments. Now we imagine doing a transport experiment. We're tunneling from essentially occupied states in iron into unoccupied states in gallium arsenide. So here are our Fermi functions. We have our polarized density of states in iron, and this is some tunneling matrix element of which I know nothing about, right? And the point here is that in the type of measurement that I've described, which is this dephasing measurement, we're only going to be sensitive to the spin polarization in the semiconductor, right? And in the unoccupied states, if we actually look at the bias where we're at, all right? We're applying a bias of there's a couple tenths of a volt drop at the source electrode. You can compute, just from assuming some simple Pauli C, what the sort of effective chemical potential difference is for the two spin states in the semiconductor. And you have a situation like this, which basically means that although there could be a spin polarization that's macroscopic here, 10 to 20% even, in the unoccupied states, there's very little difference in this distribution factor. Right? So in this case, you would not expect to see anything at the source. Recently, Chris Palmstrom provided us with samples which have much more transmissive barriers. I wish I could tell you why. Right? But as it often happens in the MBE world, the system went down for several months. And the first samples that came out of this have actually very low drops at the barriers themselves compared to the channel. And in fact, in that case, we do see signals both at source and drain. Different, but they're both there, right? Which is very preliminary, but would be consistent with this type of argument, right? At the drain, we are in a situation where, and effectively, we're tunneling from a polarized system in the gallium arsenide to a density of states in iron that's also unpolarized. The unoccupied states in iron have a spin polarization. So in this case, my little experimentalist intuition says that, yeah, well, in that case, we should have a current that depends on the spin polarization in the semiconductor. Those arguments are rather hokey, and I would be happy over the next few days to discuss this with people seriously, because it's obviously going to be prerequisite to putting some quantitative teeth on these measurements. Right. As far as interpreting what's going on, we will understand the measurements in exactly the same way as what I described before, except it's a little bit more complicated in the sense that we have some electron, and as Lou asked, these devices are very long. So once again, we have electrons that are incident on the drain, and they are unpolarized. Right? They become polarized via this reflection mechanism, the details of which I have not explained because I don't understand it. Right? And then, if we imagine that they get this, this population is created at the green point, they can diffuse and drift, and eventually, basically, will go through the barrier at some other point, which might be the blue point. Right. Well, I can just adapt what I showed you before, and this is the result for this problem. So it's, again, it's just solution to the drift diffusion equation, except now there's a second spatial integration because our detector is also a spatially extended detector extended over the width of the contact. Right. And in this case, with all those extra contacts on the device and with work on Scott Crooker's part to do some Hanley measurements, we already know they're just fixed. The spin diffusion constant, the drift velocity, the relaxation time. So they will not be parameters at all. For reasons that I won't get into details here, the actual width of the contact that we use is somewhat smaller than the physical width, right? But is fixed for all the measurements at 15 microns. And there'll be one parameter, which is essentially the amplitude of the signal, which corresponds to the efficiency of whatever this reflection process is. And when that is done, here is the data for this measurement as a function of temperature, right? So these curves, sort of Lorentzian-like, increase in width and decrease in magnitude with increasing temperature. And this is what comes out of this with basically that width parameter fixed and only the amplitude as a fitting parameter. I consider that extremely suggestive, but perhaps stronger is the fact that then we can essentially do a zero parameter fit of the imaging data that I've shown you before. So with the same structures, we can go in and actually measure the spin polarization near the drain or the source, and these are the results here. Right? So this is basically here. There's some arbitrary scaling factor, but the parameters are the same as up there. Right? So we think that is strongly suggestive of spin detection at the drain. The evolution with doping for this phenomenon is essentially what you would expect for given the doping dependence of the spin lifetime, meaning the Hanley curves get wider at higher doping. There's an additional effect here, which is commented on at the end of our paper, and Eric was asking about it this morning, which is this extremely narrow cusp-like feature that we always see in near zero field. And this is actually associated with hyperfine effects. If you're curious about it, we can talk about it. But although I used to study those in the past, I now consider them a nuisance. Right? Basically, a hyperfine field that builds up very rapidly on a scale that's basically the dipole field, which is a few Oersted, leads to a rapid dephasing. And then the applied magnetic field takes care of the rest. OK, so here is where things stand at the moment. And I'll make a few comments here about, because things have advanced a little bit since I was here in March. The spin accumulation at the drain can be detected in this Hanley-style experiment. And the fact that it's consistent with the optical measurements strongly supports that interpretation. And what I've shown you here, the signal is not sensitive to the sign of the polarization, which as a physicist doesn't bother me. As a technologist, it should. And the obvious step is to separate the source from the detector. And the easiest way to do that is in what's called non-local measurement. In other words, put a voltage probe that's very near the drain in order to measure the polarization, or better yet, to do it near the source. The straight source drain measurement remains problematic. Right? Here are actually the results. Sort of on a comparable voltage scale to what you've been seeing. Initially promising, you always see this two-step switching, regardless of the separation of the electrodes. We recently figured out this is also just an effect going on only at the drain. Does not depend on what the source is doing. So very deceptive in that respect. The spike at zero field is completely hyperfine effects. It goes away if you do the measurements extremely slowly at like a minute point. Right, but this is what led us to the non-local measurement, and I'm just going to show you one thing here because one thing that people have asked me in a few months that I've been giving this talk is, well, God, you got to show us something that's switching, so I'm going to do it. Okay, with a caveat that this is not yet sort of at my level of refinement where I've done it on a dozen devices, right? But it was repeated this last week, so I'm me feeling happy. Okay, this is the principle of the non-local measurement, right? So imagine, and this is the what's sometimes called as the Johnson-Silsby protocol, right? After work in the 80s that was done on metals by Johnson and Silsby. The idea is to put a separate contact, in this case a voltage contact, that's close to your source. So in this case, this is an incomplete cartoon done this morning. We have electrons that will come out of B and go downstream towards A, if I'm using that contact as a source. And I'm going to measure a voltage with this contact, which is C. Right? The two N contacts here, where I'm going to sink the electrons and also my reference point for the voltage, are really out at infinity. Right? They're out at 150 microns away. So we can now do this, and there are two measurements superimposed here. The red and the black, which I'll come back to in a moment, is what is the case when we're taking electrons out of B, sending them downstream towards A, and measuring the voltage between C and E. The blue and the green are what you see when you have electrons that are going into B, measuring with between C and E. All right? And as you see, that's a very complicated mess. And that's what was distressing us all along as we were trying to measure these systems, that we always had this contribution. If you only look at the source now, in non-local geometry, right? You see a relatively clean switching between parallel and anti-parallel states, right? And in both these states, you see a Hanley effect. So if you now apply a field that's perpendicular to the magnetization of your electrodes, you can kill off the signal, right? So Zhao has done a lot of other work in the last several weeks that I don't have time to discuss, but the sort of moving out of this trap that was set for us by this physics that goes back to what was discovered here in the ferromagnetic imprinting work, we can now measure the spin accumulation with a separate voltage measurement. So I think from this point forward, that will help us out. In particular, you know, if you guys can help us with this y-axis as to why we should be measuring the magnitudes and signs of the voltages that we're measuring, I think I look forward to talking about that with people. So I'll stop there. Lenny?
That's a bigger supposition, but suppose you replace grain by non-magnetic metal.
Mm-hmm.
Will it affect the...
So the only experiments that have been done are aluminum, with aluminum, and this peak at the drain is just not there, right? I will say that we've had terrible trouble doing reverse bias Schottkys with anything but iron, right? So I can't make a source drain measurement with the same noise characteristics as these ones, right? So I could put up the data, and you'll see nothing. But that's because the reverse biased aluminum Schottky diode is extremely noisy. And for the otherwise identical doping profile, that's just an experimentalist nightmare.
So summarizing, the sign of accumulation doesn't depend on the polarization of magnetization. Does depend on the direction of magnetization in iron, right? Does not.
Well, no. Yes. I miscommunicated. This stuff at the end where we've just recently been able to do. When we're doing this stuff, we simply cannot tell what state the iron is in, because we're using the same electrode to inject and detect. Right? Now you can measure optically, right? And that way you could tell what your spin state in the semiconductor is. But presumably the fact, it's proven, the fact that the iron is magnetic gives you this signal, right? But it will always be determined by the polarization of the iron. Right? So you cannot determine the, for example, if I asked you to read out the magnetization state of the iron, you could not do it based on this measurement alone, right? We can do it, at least tell whether things are parallel or anti-parallel from this measurement. Right? And this is, you know, what you'll traditionally see, but now we can back it up with that, which shows that things dephase as they should. Right? So, you know, this is sort of an I'm a plotting, boring type of person. So I can take my measurements one step at a time. And what I tell people about the imaging data is that, okay, yes, it's quite possible that we discovered nothing in that experiment. We had to deal with this in the case of one referee. Right? You said, well, you know, that's been observed. But you can put it all together, and actually that was very critical in sort of just figuring out what was going on. Right? Doing just your two-point, well, I can show you, you know, look at those blue and green curves. And that's not even the two-point measurement. That's actually a drain non-local measurement. The two-point one is even more sort of baroque. But yes, what was in the PRL, so this effect, you cannot use to determine the magnetization state of the ion.
So in light of these new measurements, do you think you understand that now, that craziness that you showed?
The craziness in this stuff? Sort of. This is actually the real problem. There's a double jump here that's just due to the drain. Right? So the interpretation of this stuff is classic. Right? You have source, you know, your source and detector either parallel or anti-parallel. I think this is showing, as does the zero field spike, a lot of very long timescale dependence. And if you look at the literature for DNP, you'll see these bizarre hysteresis effects that are observed. This is just an optical pumping. And we're wondering actually if we're getting that. So basically, you get a sharp step. It actually would be this one. And then this is actually the other electrode going. And the rest of this behavior seems to be associated with something that's occurring on a long time scale just at the drain. So the short answer to your question is no, we haven't figured it out yet. But we can now straighten out what's real spin transport from what's just going on at the drain. Right. Well, in the non-local case, I mean, so you might want to know what magnitude of signal this is. The voltage bias across the channel in this experiment is about a volt, right? And you're measuring 3 microvolts. In principle, in a non-local measurement, what we'd call the balance signal should be zero, right? If you really had no voltage drop between the between this point and this point, because all the electrons are flowing that way. And at the moment, that's still a millivolt. So you know, obviously, if you just convert this to magnetoresistance, two-terminal, it would just be infinitesimal. But it's measurable.
Okay.
In a metal, I really would. And in a metal and metallic devices, they have managed to make this essentially comparable to this signal. But yeah, I realize in the semiconductor, there's going to be some reasonably complicated current path. So I was not surprised that off-balance signal was a millivolt. All right.
Is there any questions? This thing, call me, could be around all week for our board.